Back now to Dr. Malachi Martin. And, Doctor, you're
yes.
in, I haven't even told everybody, you're in Manhattan, aren't you?
That's right. I live in Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
upper Manhattan.
Doctor, as a young priest, how did you first, what was your first exorcism, and how was you, what was your reaction to it?
Well, my first exorcism was in Cairo, Egypt. And I was a young priest, and I was an archaeologist. I was lying on my belly or my back in caves on the Sinai Peninsula, copying inscriptions. Inscriptions dating from about the time of Abraham, about 1600 or 1700 B.C. That's about, what, 3,000 years ago, more than 3,000 years ago.
Long time ago, yes.
And an exorcism was going on, and I didn't know it, when I came back down by plane and checked into Cairo, because I came down every couple of weeks to get a bath and to eat properly.
Yes.
Because we lived on goat's cheese and black coffee when we were up digging. One of the priests was telling me that he was engaged in an exorcism and his assistant has collapsed, which is not uncommon with young assistants, because in your first exorcism, if you've never done it before, the impact is so great, sometimes you become totally incontinent. It scares you.
To the point where you can't move and can't speak and can't help.
And everything, all the portals are loosened. You have diarrhea. You vomit. Because it's so repellent. It's so shocking.
So it's not for the weak of heart.
No, it's not. And I'll describe in a moment exactly what is the repellent part about it.
All right.
But so I was asked to assist, so I did. And apparently I had a very strong constitution, still have. And I hadn't got that effect. It had a disgusting effect. It always has. That was the first time, and it was a very sticky exorcism. In general, if you want to understand what an exorcism is like, and what's really the essence of the difficulty, the horror of it, is this. You must imagine, say, a common scene. It's a room. It's always within a house. It's in a room. There's nothing on the walls. No nails, no pictures, nothing that can move. If the windows are there, they're barred, which shatters. You don't have glass around the place that can be shattered.
All of this is prepared.
All this is prepared. And you have the person in question is either violent or not. Most times not violent to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And there's either a bed, an iron bed, or a chair, or whatever. There's you have no table, but people... You have an exorcist with an assistant, and he has an assistant there. The assistant is a priest, and then he has several other people, usually men, dressed in clothes that can take a lot of hardware. And they carry everything in their hands. They have to have a candle, and they have to have holy water, and they have to have the priest's a prayer book, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the point. I said before that people go undergo a psychiatric examination, undergo a medical examination, and finally people say, okay, let's try exorcism.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that within the first 20 minutes, you know if it's a real case of possession, and then you're into it, and you can't withdraw. You can't simply say, okay, boys, let's break up and see each other next Monday. You can't do that. Once you start it, you've got to finish it.
Or else what? Why?
Or else you are pursued by that demon.
You are pursued. The
yes.
exorcist.
That's right. And everybody in that room has troubles. And the troubles can be extraordinary. I mean, I've seen assistants trying to hold somebody down and dropping the person and looking at each other because the possessed person starts telling one man what the other man did to his wife.
Oh, boy.
Well, yes, we've been through that, too. And sometimes it's a lie, sometimes it's true, sometimes it's an exaggeration. Anyway, but after the first 20 minutes, what happens? In that 20 minutes, the following happens. Now, the temperature of the room may change, there may be a horrible smell, there may not be a horrible smell. All those are incidental things, the olfactory experience or the heat and the cold experience. But here's the real point. At a certain moment, if it's really an exorcism,
mm-hmm.
and if we are in the presence of a possessing spirit or a threatening spirit, demon. Everybody in the room, the priest and his assistant and the assistants, they know, and I can only call on some experiences of people listening to me, and you yourself, Art, you know there's something in the room that wants you dead, but dead. I mean, I've only been twice in my life threatened with real death, but really threatened. Once was in Czechoslovakia, and once was in America. And it's a horrible feeling knowing that unless something happens, you are going to die. Now!
Yes.
And that's the it's like an invisible animal with claws, and it wants you dead. It really wants your life's blood. It wants you extinguished.
Has it happened, Doctor? Has an assistant or an exorcist or anybody present at an exorcism ever been killed?
Well, no, but they have died of heart attack. They've died of some form of internal health attack. None of them have been killed, exactly, except in one case. I wasn't present at it. There was a case in America where the person was flung out a window and defenestrated and killed 8 stories down.
Well, out a window or a heart attack, it's dead.
Oh, it's dead. But the point is that the experience is everybody in the room suddenly knows. You don't even look at each other, you know. Especially if you've done exorcism before with the same team. You know, this is it. We're now in that presence. And the point is this. Here's the point I want to drive home. It's a confrontation. It's not a series of prayers, of pious wishes, and of deliverance and healing invocations. No. This is a confrontation between the exorcist's will and the possessing demon or the harassing demon. And thereby, then, there comes the conversation. Because the exorcist has to find out the name, what the demon calls himself, if we want to speak about himself. It's not himself or herself, as we all know. But anyway, what their name is. And the name is usually a reflection of their function, what their function is as an evil spirit. And you have to get them to admit that. There are certain rules. You never answer a question put to you by the possessed person. You always fling a question back at them.
How do you know when you are speaking with that demon?
It is impossible not to know at once the person starts talking. It is impossible not to know. You know. Everybody in the room knows. And it's not a change of voice. Sometimes the voice is a big change in the voice. Sometimes it's a small change. But there's something, the manifestation of the spirit, when it's cornered by an authorized exorcist, is palpably clear, like the nose in your face. Everybody knows. And there's no deception about it. And it has this bone-chilling effect.
So it's like a war.
It's a war.
Once it begins.
It's a real confrontation. And this is where people make a mistake about treating with evil spirits. If they think or suspect or know that they're being bothered, they attempt to take it on themselves, and you can't do it. You have no authority.
Well, I was going to say, this is one of those don't try it at home things. In other words,
that's right.
You don't sit by a bed and attempt yourself, not knowing what you're doing,
to say
a nice little prayer that this spirit will leave the body.
You can do that if you want to, and it's okay to do it, and it does relieve the pressure and the tension, blah, 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 blah. But it does not. It does not dispossess a possessing spirit. It does not. For that, you need authority. And this is the difficulty that Buddhists and Jews and non-Catholics sometimes come to us and say, we've been trying exorcism and it doesn't work. And one would laugh if it weren't so pathetic at times. Because they must have it's only the authority of Christ can get rid of the spirit. And that's what takes place. And then that can be long or short. It can be a long game of cat and mouse trying to trap the demon, trying to get it to conceal, and then it lapses into complete silence or violence.
Doctor, we hear of successes at the end. The story usually ends well. Are there failures? Are there times
when... There are failures where it's total failure. And that is calamitous, because then that means the person goes ahead possessed. It means that the exorcist has sacrificed something for nothing, Because let me explain something to your art, which is very hard to explain, but there are parallels, analogies in life that helps. When you do exorcism, you give something which you can't get back. It's like, for instance, any parent who has reared children will tell you, oh, I gave them so much love.
Yes.
And they're not talking about money or food. They're thinking about what they gave of themselves. You give of yourself in love and affection and devotion and planning, etc., etc.
And
you can't get it back. And no parent wants it back, really. Similarly with an exorcism, the exorcist gives, a little part of him dies, put it like that, and goes away and waits for him in heaven.
Little slice of death.
Yes, a little slice. And, for instance, after a bad exorcism, I mean a long, unhealthy one, you don't eat very much for a couple of weeks, and you don't sleep very deeply either. You can't. You can't. You've been locked in combat with a very, very insalubrious, unhealthy, anti-human, heating spirit that has communicated with you.
For those not of faith, are there, during the course of exorcisms, actual physical manifestations in or near the person or around the person or in the room, as in the movie? Do things ever move? Do you actually...
Oh, yes, things move. If there's anything movable in the room, it's going to move. If there are nails on the wall, if there are pictures, if there are windows that can be broken, they'll probably be broken. If there's something which is weak, unbreakable, it can break. It can move. So you want to have a very bare situation completely. And even then, the exorcist is not free once it's all over. I've been flung out of bed. I've been knocked off stools and broken my shoulder by the demon. Get his own back just to remind me he was there and to make me pay a price for the damage I did.
This is like going to war. It's very much like going to war.
Going to war. What most people don't realize is that there's a spiritual war on, and as St. Paul says, it's a war with the spirits. It's a war with the forces of evil, the invisible forces that want men's souls.
Are there times as a priest
mm-hmm.
where even the very best of men, Doctor, sometimes fear war reasonably. Does a priest sometimes fear entering this war when you know you are about to meet up once again with the worst?
Yes, there's always that fear. And a very old exorcist gave me advice years ago in Ireland. I mentioned this to him, and he said, okay, but listen, learn to measure your love of God by the amount of fear in your heart. Which is a very profound statement.
It is, yes.
Because it depends on how much you love God. And if you really love Him as Father, as Savior, and as final end of everything, and as the beautifier, and as the creator of nature, the creator of all beauty in our lives, it can expel fear. But if you nourish fear, fear can grow and not quantitatively, but it can equal or surpass the amount of love you have in your heart. And then you're in danger, because that fear is going to make you despair. That fear is going to make you timorous. That fear is going to make you vulnerable.
Vulnerable.
Love is the only thing that can cure it. Love is the only protection we have.
You mentioned there were priests who do not believe that people are possessed.
That's right. That's right.
Do they carry that belief because of fear, do you think, for the most part, or...?
No, Art. The cases I have known are priests whose faith has been diminished. See, faith is not a quantum, like a bank balance or something in your pocket.
Yes.
Or clothes you wear. It's a dimension of soul. And that dimension can be great or less, greater or lesser. And it can be diminished by infidelities, by sin, by fecklessness, by carelessness. It can be increased by virtue. It can be increased by good actions. It can be increased by the grace of God. But it's usually because of the lack of faith. faith, when they think that there's no such thing as evil, really, that it's okay, do what you like, just don't frighten the horses. But there are iron laws, though. God has laws, and he doesn't allow them to violate it. You can violate them, but you're going to pay the price. And one of the prices is that you slowly but surely edge towards that region of human existence where the demons are dominant. And they will satisfy you. They'll give you a good life. But you end up, they're a prisoner. They're a prisoner.
Is there ever a case where the person who is possessed dies in the course of the exorcism?
Yes, it has happened. And it's caused untold trouble because there's usually a lawsuit. But that's why we are very careful as regards the medical condition of the persons that we exorcise.
You say there's a lawsuit.
The husband or the wife or the boy or the friend or the son or the daughter sue the priest.
Sue the priest?
Yeah. For having put their relative through an experience that caused them to have a heart attack, caused them to have a coronary, whatever. It has happened.
What would happen, doctor, to the soul of the person who would die under such circumstances?
Under their circumstances, we must say we don't know. There's always the chance. You know the old story between the bridge and the water? This man was pursued by his enemies and living in sin, and he tried to jump over a bridge and swim into the water, but they shot him.
Yes.
But before his body hit the water, he had repented. There's always this. You never know. You just never know. I just wouldn't like to be in that position myself.
Has that happened to you?
Yes, it has happened to me. It has happened to me. And it's very distressing. And then I've been asked to go to see people who are possessed by their husband or their wife or their brother or their sister and come away empty-handed. They simply told me to go to hell. Literally.
Well, that would be one pretty good sign, wouldn't it? I mean, it's just not something you do is tell a priest to go to hell.
It's very discouraging. Very discouraging, and they do it with great hate. Great hate.
Well, as I say, wouldn't that be a very clear sign?
It is. It is, Art.
And so if you are told to go to hell, to get out of here, I don't want anything to do with you, which I can imagine, more than not, you might be told, then what do you do?
Well, yeah, you go away and you pray. But, you see, for instance, if I go into the greengrocer and I find the milk he's supplying me is rotten, and I say, listen, this milk is smells highly, he can say, listen, buddy, get the hell out of here. That's one way. That merely means stop bothering me. But if somebody tells you in the way that it does happen now and again to an exorcist, please go to hell. Because that's where I'm going. I want to be with the prince. Now I'm quoting a certain case to you. Then it chills your bones. Because you know you're up against somebody perfectly possessed who just is waiting to die and go home to his master.
Have you ever wondered, doctor, about your own heart, about your own constitution going into one of these?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. And my heart specialist has always warned me that there's a danger there. And I know there is. There is. But, you see, when you're over 70, you know, the amount of good you can do in this world is limited because you're no longer 20, 25, 30. And therefore, whatever good you can do, you do if you're wise. Because one day soon, I'm going to take the high jump.
As we all shall.
As we all shall.
So, even today, if you encountered it, you would still do it?
Oh, yes, I would. Oh, yes, I would. Because the commiseration, the human compassion, and the pity that the Holy Spirit puts in your heart impels you, because they are miserable, and they make appeals to you, and they, unless they're completely possessed.
Doctor, hold tight, relax,
sure.
And I can use a moment of relaxation as well, and we'll be right back to you. My guest is Dr. Malachi Martin. This is CBC.